You're listening to the Food Talk Show. Hi there, this is the Food Talk Radio Show, and each week we taste innovative, new and interesting food or drink. Terrible part of the job. And we take a look at the latest food tech advances from across the UK. Hello everyone, my name is Sue Nelson and I'm joined by the lovely Guy Routledge, co-founder of Food Rush. Hi Guy.
Hi Sue, how are you doing today?
Yeah, fresh from last week. We had so much to do, we could barely fit it in the programme, could we?
Yeah, maybe we need to extend a bit more, isn't it?
Yeah, I think we need to be a bit more relaxed this week.
Well, I think it was a bit boozy last time, wasn't it? So I think you got a bit carried away.
And it was a bit boozy with the alcoholic pastels. Yes, I was pretty chuffed with that. The other thing we forgot to mention last week, because we were in such a rush trying to get everything in, is our Food Talk Awards.
Ah, of course, yes.
Food Talk Awards, but we're just coming to the end now. If you haven't submitted yet, you need to get it in. And if you don't know about the Food Talk Awards, you need to go on to foodtalkawards.com. And basically, we're looking for anybody, the mavericks out there. We're looking for the mavericks, the people who are passionate and doing something different. So it's not about taste necessarily. It's about people who are doing amazing and different things. So go on to Food Talk Awards. And if you haven't applied, you should be. It's free to enter. And what's the prize, really, for all these different categories?
Well, it's a wonderful prize. You get to come and hang out with us for the afternoon.
On the radio show. So we'll all of our category winners will be having guest appearances on our radio show, which is a great way to promote yourself and get on our podcast and get on all the different radio shows we feature. So
absolutely. And we've got a whole load of really interesting and innovative categories that people can enter into as well. So we've got ones for drink, ones for clean eating, ones for food in general, I suppose, one for free from, which is very relevant to some of the things we're going to be talking about today.
It is.
We've got food writing, the smart kitchen. That one sounds quite interesting.
We see some great gadgets, don't we?
We really do. Sometimes I feel my smartest in the kitchen, which is always nice.
And of course, packaging,
and also the wild card, our favourite kind of category around here, where we're going to be kind of looking at all the weird and wonderful things that we've seen in and around town.
That's our choice, that one, isn't it? All the things we've seen on the show for the last year, we're going to choose our own prize. You don't have to submit for that. We're going to choose our own because we've seen. Oh, we've just had some incredible guests. So let's have a look at what we've got this week. I'm sitting next to David Booth, Tech City Ventures. Welcome, David.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Good. And just tell me a little bit about what Tech City Ventures is in the first place before we start looking at other stuff.
Sure. Tech City Ventures is the current iteration of what started out as a company called Tech City Tours. Now, we originally set up about 3 years ago, and we're running these immersive tour sessions so that anyone coming into London technology for the first time could come in and have an introduction to the London tech scene, what does that mean, and then run through and meet two or three different startups and usually an investor or an ecosystem player. And then we've more recently started building out these really custom bespoke versions of that same tour concept, but under the Connect brand. So a lot of corporate groups, government groups, international delegations come through, and we'll introduce them to two or three startups, to a local investor, and really get them immersed in the local tech scene culture.
And is London where it's at, in your particular opinion?
So I've had good coverage of a few different tech hubs around the world now. I'm a New Zealander and still passionate about space back there. I've spent some time over in Silicon Valley, lived there for 12, 13 months. London, I'm really excited about, just it has all the right elements for me. There's a lot happening. It's not overhyped like a lot of the valley is.
Mm. That's because we're British. We like to downplay. Yeah. How
fly under the radar.
Yeah.
So even though you're based here, you're not biased at all. London is where it's at.
I'm really excited about London tech right now.
Yep. So what's the element? You said there's particular elements that are all sort of coming together to make London a pretty interesting place. What are those key things for you?
The biggest thing for anywhere around the world is the talent. And when I say talent, you mean the entrepreneurs who are actually building the startups. And often it's not the the ones that get out there the first time and are excited to get into it. Obviously, that's really important, but it's actually the experience capital or the experience mentorship layer that you have an entrepreneur that's been through. You know, they've been successful or not, hopefully successful, but sometimes not. And then they're able to contribute to the next generation. And what's really making an impact here right now is that first generation of tech entrepreneurs over the last 5 or 10 years, their companies are starting to mature. There's some major exits recently. There's some secondary liquidity where some of these early founders have been able to sort of step back and say, I've been successful, I've done what I have, and now it's time to give back. And it's that layer that really allows the early stage to flourish. I mean, what you see here is a second generation or maybe third generation Silicon Valley is really the only, what it is really what it is, because it's got 4 or 5 of those cycles already played out.
So it's, as they like to say in America, sending the elevator down. And I'm quite keen on that, particularly for women in business, is if you're doing well and you've had people that help you, it's your turn to send the elevator down and help bring somebody else up. And I do think that if you have been successful, and of course you've worked hard to be successful, but there's a little bit of luck in that sometimes, then it's your duty to help somebody else to reach where you have.
Absolutely. I mean, the more successful you are, the more people want your time. So I suppose you have to start building a process for how you allocate your time. Which I sort of think in the same way that you would as an investor. I mean, you have a scarce resource of time, or an investor has capital, and you're going to invest a little bit in a lot of people, and then the best ones that make the most of that and really take your advice and grow, you'll invest more time in.
That's a really interesting way to think of time. I think anybody who works in business, they're always like, oh, I'm so busy, I haven't got enough time. But time is like a currency, right? It's something that you spend. You can either spend it wisely or you can spend it foolishly. That's a really brilliant analogy. I love that.
But I think that's what, if you talk to a lawyer or an accountant, and I used to be a management consultant, people used to say, what do you do? And I say, well, I sell time. Because actually what I do is I sell my time. And that's exactly what a lawyer does.
It's not very scalable, is it?
They have expertise. No, it's not. It's quite difficult. They have expertise, but what they're selling is they're selling their time. And the most obvious is a lawyer, because they're marking out every 6 minutes, all that sort of stuff. Yeah. But in terms of being a management consultant or any type of consultant, that's what you're selling. You've got expertise and you're chunking up your time and you're selling it. But as you say, that's not scalable, because people want to talk to you. They don't want to talk to somebody else.
And it's something that I've experienced myself, and I'm sure you have as well, that idea of, people want to talk to you and there's not enough of you to go around. So, yeah, it's a challenging one.
A lot of people don't want to talk to me, which is why I'm on the radio, because I make them talk to me.
You make them listen.
You get to talk to everyone.
I'm not sure about that. So are there any other elements as well? We've got a very good sort of mentoring, nurturing culture, in your opinion. Are there other elements that you think are key?
Yes, I mean, the obvious one, I suppose, that gets a lot of attention is the capital. When I say the risk capital available to invest in early stage ventures, and the ecosystem's come a long way there as well in the last 10 years. I mean, I think Seedcamp was around 10 years ago, or slightly more this year, and one of the first early stage investors and accelerators in the market. And since then, I don't have stats on it, off the top of my head, but there's 30, 40 plus seed funds in the valley in London. There's also a lot of early stage capitals coming through the EIS and SEIS tax credits that are available to early investors that, if they have a choice of paying tax or investing in companies, often they choose to invest in companies, funnily enough.
And in EIS, just to clarify, is the Enterprise Investment Scheme.
Correct.
And the SEIS is for companies that are completely new. If you do have bags of money hanging about, can't say that I'm in that bracket, and I definitely know Guy isn't. I'm making an assumption there. Sorry, Guy.
No, it's fair enough.
I was just looking at your hoodie today. But EIS is a great way of if you are a 40%, taxpayer of actually reducing the tax that you're paying, and at the same time you're helping, you're helping startups. So it's a very good scheme, actually.
Well, there's another layer on top of that as well. I think it's definitely a net positive. There is a risk that comes along with it that if there's too much of this capital in the system where it isn't incentivized the right way, if an investor comes along and their primary motive is to get the tax break and not really to help the company on an ongoing basis, The company can find itself in a position of having raised money, not having access to more, and not having the attention of the investor that they really need, and the sort of the expertise that they really need to grow to the next level. One thing I'm seeing emerge now, which is potentially a solution, it's not going all the way, but there's more and more EIS funds, which instead of the individual putting their money straight into the company and then walking away, they'll put their money into the fund and have a...
And the fund will manage where it goes.
So, yeah.
And invest in many different startups, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, Syndicate Room comes to mind. They've got a one of these which was going to do 20 or 30 deals across the course of a year, and you can write a check and you get your updates and you get your events with the companies. But I suppose the difference is that the investments are actually made behind people who are professional investors who are really adding value, and it allows them to ramp up their ability to contribute. And it's quite an interesting space right now.
Very.
We're joined as well today by Lucy Wager. Hi, Lucy. How you doing?
Hello. Very well, thank you.
Good, good. And we're obviously going to come on and talk about your company in a minute. Have you got any... I mean, we were talking just off air before we started in terms of... Businesses are still businesses, and they still need to be run, you know, with, I'm afraid, accounting and law, legal background and contracts and all that sort of stuff. Is there some real advice that you would give? I mean, cash is still king, isn't it? If you haven't got the cash flow, you're stuffed, really.
Particularly in this space, I mean, since we're here to talk about food tech, you don't go out there and propose to build a business that doesn't have a clear path to revenue. I mean, it's okay to invest in R&D. It's okay to invest in inventory. Inventory is a really tricky one for this kind of company because you've got to have stuff before you can sell it.
We're going to talk about puddings. You've got to have puddings before you can start. We're going to talk about that in a minute.
Yeah, exactly.
With Lucy.
You've got to have pudding before you can eat it. I mean,
yeah, very much so.
But I mean, there's crowdfunding solutions is one really interesting approach here, where you can pre-sell or raise crowdfunding to back and to show that a product, almost to validate that the market wants the product before you go in and invest millions of dollars producing it, which is kind of
that's
the
something
lines.
That you've got a background in, isn't it? Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. I can tell you the short or the long version of the story.
We're a radio show that's for an hour, so if it's a two-hour version, it probably won't.
That's not going to fit,
David.
Let's take the short one for now, and we'll see if we like it. We'll go for the long one.
Exactly. So let's just very quickly. My background is in a few different. I actually had a startup of my own in the food space in New Zealand, and then venture capital in New Zealand, and we were investing and leading small rounds on and sort of closing rounds with other investors involved, effectively leading these syndicates. So. When I first saw Angelist appear, I'm not sure if your listeners will be familiar with Angelist, but it's a Silicon Valley-based platform for startups, enabling startups to raise money online, recruit early-stage employees on time online, launch products.
A lot of nurture them through that bit.
A lot of really interesting resources there. I joined Angelist in 2014 to sort of consolidate and build a team around the fundraising operations function. So sounds kind of boring, I suppose, but I found it fascinating. This is when crowdfunding was first emerging, and Angelist was running 20 or 30 investments every month, where a lead investor who was committing to investing their own money would come to Angelist, and we'd set them up a fund online and help them to round up sort of online capital. So up to 99 people investing in every one of these online funds. The biggest thing, I mean, that was my entry point. I mean, I'm now, you know, following very closely what's happening in the space and looking at what CrowdCube and Seed is and guys like Crowdfooding I mentioned earlier are doing. The biggest thing I see is that, you know, crowdfunding isn't for everyone. It can be detrimental to some companies, but for the companies where it's valuable, where sort of the potential investor is also a potentially really valuable community advocate and potential customer.
Yeah, and if they've got some really good background, you know, they could be helping you in say they're a social media expert or something like that. You should be trying to get your investors to help you because it's in their interest.
Exactly. If you're building a brand, then crowdfunding can be a way to really leverage your community.
Leverage
it's almost like a marketing activity, isn't it? Because it's a great way to, you know, build buzz and get people together and you know, really get some buy-in for what it is you're doing. I guess it can happen at different stages. You can either try and validate your concept through crowdfunding, Before you've even started to, you know, really see what the flavor is, or you can do it at, you know, maybe at one of those pinch points of going from very early stage to the next stage up. Do you think there is like a, you know, a better way to go with it, or?
I mean, I what I'm finding, guys, is that everybody was into crowdfunding, and it, you know, and the reason why crowdfunding's been quite successful is because, you know, the interest rates are rubbish. So you can't put your money anywhere else. You're not going to get any. You're not going to get anything back, unless you put it in premium bonds, possibly. But and so, you know, it is an alternative for sort of savers, in inverted commas. I have heard that crowdfunding is really struggling at the moment, and that it wasn't what it was. Is that what you're finding, David?
I think
just a rumor on the street that's been made up.
Well, one thing that's certainly true is that the industry is in the UK, I suppose, approaching 5 or 6 years old. Investment returns in the early stage technology space, which crowdfunding was sort of, and this is equity crowdfunding we're speaking about, as opposed to...
Yeah, I was going to clarify, it's not the rewards-based, it's you actually put money in and you get a small slice.
In fact, that's worth defining right now as rewards-based crowdfunding, and the most famous platforms being Kickstarter and Indiegogo in the States. Allow you to put your product, hardware product or whatever it is online.
Or even food or food tech product.
Exactly. As opposed to the equity crowdfunding, which I think you might be referring to here.
I'm actually referring to equities. And what that means is that basically you put your money in and you get some shares in the company, essentially. And some of the other stuff is literally a loan. You're loaning your money and you expect to get a certain percentage return. So there's those two different ones, isn't there?
So the risk, as I say, the industry is approaching 5 to 6, 7 years old, and often it takes that long for any returns to start to show. A venture capital fund is structured as a 10-year investment for anyone who's investing in it, because you simply can't get the money out before that.
So it is not a get-rich-quick scheme.
I am a bit concerned that maybe some of the expectations around crowdfunding haven't really been set right from the start. So people investing have not, you know, seen the immediate returns that they expected. They haven't seen their companies growing up to be the next Coca-Cola like they expected. They haven't been able to get their money back out when they wanted to.
So is that just being unrealistic, or are they being sort of slightly missold, or is it because we only ever hear the hype about the big ones that suddenly get money quick, which, let's face it, is incredibly rare, but that's the ones we hear about.
You certainly do hear more about the success cases.
Or the massive failures as well.
Yep.
Maybe not so much in the equity crowdfunding space, but certainly on Kickstarter. I mean, you know, all of the tech media loves to say, oh, look at these guys, they really, really screwed it up. I don't know why we like to do that, but, you know, human nature, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the only answer is a combination of the above. There are some returns starting to come through. I think there's absolutely a risk that if the right companies aren't coming through crowdfunding, and if some people are missing out on some really big successes, they say, you know, I was investing online but I didn't get the chance to do this one, and so obviously online investing isn't the way. So the next 2 or 3 years will really be the proving ground, and it'll be time to show some returns.
Be interesting to see as well if the interest rates go up quite a lot, although I can't see that myself much.
You mean outside of the crowdfunding space?
Yeah, no, people just start then putting their money somewhere else because they get better returns than they currently
do. They're incredibly low at the moment, yeah.
One thing, I mean, just thinking on that is with AngelList, one thing we saw was a lot of companies actually didn't want to go through crowdfunding. As I say, they weren't suited to it. And so when everything sort of moved towards following the lead investor as opposed to the investing in the company directly online, there's been a lot of really high quality companies that just no one knows about because they're private on AngelList. You know, they're only available to the people who are already back in the lead. And that does sort of have a bit of a negative PR bias, because if you're only hearing about the middle band or the lower band and the best ones aren't getting any visibility, then that doesn't necessarily indicate the health of crowdfunding as a whole. So it's really an education piece for investors. Yeah.
I think in the food sector space, I mean, we see a lot of food tech. But aside from the food tech, if you look at the producer end,
like packaged goods and stuff like that.
Yeah, I do think people aren't, well, they're not funded well enough. And I think you could put that across any business, really. if you haven't got a lot of money and you're going to try and grow organically, that's a huge monumental task. And growing, you will grow slowly, I think, because, you know, how do you get the funding? I'm trying to raise some decent funding. It is for me, it's a much better way. I'd rather work for a couple of years and get the money together. Being older with 35 years hindsight, I think that's easier than trying to do it on a shoestring. I think it's really, really tough. Can I just ask you, Lucy, have you done yours on a shoestring? I've just offended you now I've said that.
No, absolutely not. You've recognised the very difficult challenge that lies for people that try and, you know, create something without huge, deep pockets. I wouldn't say I've done it on a shoestring, but compared to someone like Coca-Cola, then yes, I suppose I have done it on a shoestring.
We've all done it on a shoestring compared to them, yes.
But no, I mean, even compared to some of the sort of, you know, other well-known brands that are bigger than us, we will have done it on a shoestring. When I first started the business, I was very keen to make sure I was protecting my idea. Having worked in the food industry and in two retailers, I know very well the world of retail and the food industry. And it can sometimes not be a very nice place where people will, you know, take an idea. There's no, you know, it's not like some other industries where you can, you know, copyright your idea and everything's very safe. Recipes just aren't safe. So in the beginning,
how do you prove it?
Well, exactly. You can put a little bit more of something in, take a bit out, and it's a different recipe. So in the early days, I was very protective of the idea that I'd come up with. And I was adamant that it was going to be branded to sort of create, because I love brands myself. I like being advertised to. I'm a marketing man's dream in that way. I love brands.
Guy
basically.
Is as well. Yeah. He buy anything that's new and different and tastes good.
Yeah, that's almost true.
Well, that's perfect. Mm. That's what we like. And, you know, brands, I just love brands. I love brands that talk to people, and I think you can get your personality across in brands. So having said that, you would think that I would want massive marketing budgets and, you know, to really get my brand out there, which is true. I did want that, but I didn't have that. I also was quite greedy about my idea, and I didn't, in the early days, want to give any equity away. So that idea of...
Now, I think that's really important. We're going to go on to your pudding story in a minute, because it's really important. Also, we're hoping you bought some samples, because if you haven't, we're all going to be really upset. Okay, that's good. Yeah. That's good. So there's a couple of points there that Lucy's brought up, David, which I think are really important. First one's about protection. And I think if you're going to be an investor, one of the things I would want to know as an investor is how have you protected this so that somebody's not going to come along and steal it? And that's a real big decision for an investor, isn't it? That's one of the things they'll look at straight away. Or am I just making that up?
It varies with sector, and food is one that I'd agree with you that, you know, the recipe is something that, because it can't really be protected that, you know, that easily with the traditional, you know, you can't patent it. You could probably copyright it, but that, you know, again, as you say, they can get around that by changing one ingredient.
Exactly. Yep.
But the thing, I mean, my advice with startups generally is protection is a waste of time. Your advantage is in the team's ability to out-innovate anyone that comes out after them. And
you're talking about food products here, as opposed to maybe technology or gadgets or something like that.
The most obvious example would be, I mean, a software startup. There's no point in trying to protect the code that you're writing to patent the function that your software performs, because the time that you spend doing that is time that you're not spending making the product better, and you're not spending making the user experience better. And ultimately, the only value in the business is having the better product and its ability to drive, you know, user retention and things in the future.
Yeah, I mean, I think you should protect what you're doing. But the problem with code is by the time you've finished it and you get your patent 2 years later, you've moved on. So there's not much, doesn't appear to be much point.
It's also tough because it's made out of something which is inherently open in many ways. And I mean, there's a lot of software is made up of open source parts. So those are bits that are, you know, freely available, and you can use them without changing them, or you can change them, do whatever you want with them. So it's a bit more.
But I think when we talked last week with Melanie about her, she makes gin and tonic pastels. You missed that, David. Oh my goodness, they were like wow, they were
they
amazing.
Were very good.
She's gone for a patent for that because she has done something different, and it is patentable.
And
but
that makes a lot of sense.
Quite rare, and that does make a lot of sense, doesn't it? And as an investor, I'd be quite interested in somebody who's patented something like that, because she is protecting her market. But it's hard to do, isn't it?
I mean, within sectors, it makes a lot of sense. If you're building, you know, biotechnology, if you're building and sort of the supply end of the agri-technology, agri agricultural technology, sorry. And yes, in certain elements of food tech, it makes a lot of sense. For others, I'd say it really comes down to the brand. And like you say, that a strong brand that has a community around it and has a following and can drive a purchase decision is going to be more valuable than spending the same time that could have been spent building that brand.
Although that being said, I think it's important to trademark a brand. Correct. Because that is,
if you can. Yes.
If you can't, then maybe
Food Talk's trademarked. Just thought I'd let you know. Oh, fantastic. Is anybody thinking of nicking it? Don't bother. Yeah. We've tied that one right.
Food
up.
And talking, yes.
Food Talk, yeah. Yeah. But but it is important to protect.
No, absolutely. Because that name, there's so much tied up in it,
One of the best examples, and just going back to the earlier comment about working on a shoestring, sometimes it actually can be an advantage. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the example I love of the Dollar Shave Club with their launching their subscription revenue.
Subscription. What a great video razors. As well. One of my favourite videos of all time.
And going up against and carving a meaningful niche of the market away from
Gillette and all those. Yeah.
The likes of
it. And it was done on a shoestring. And part of the reason it was so successful because it was done on a shoestring and the business was launched from the ground up.
And they had no boundaries or no rules.
And there certainly wasn't any IP protection in that business because you can't patent their razor. It was a similar razor with a far better brand experience and community around it.
Mm. No, absolutely brilliant. So, David, thank you very much for that. We're obviously going to talk to you, for the rest of the programme, although we are going to focus on puddings, which we're quite excited by. Just before we talk to Lucy, we're going to go over to we'll talk about fish. So let's hear about that and then we'll come back into the studio. Hi, my name's Sue Nelson and I'm at the Taste of Kent Awards 2017 and I'm with the lovely Barry from Hollishaw Fisheries, who's just shouted his head off because he's just won Kent Fishmonger of the Year 2007. How do you feel after getting that? Was it a surprise?
Yeah, no, really brilliant. We was here last year and we was runners-up and we've sort of pushed our game a little bit this year and we've managed to win and it's really brilliant.
Second's nowhere, isn't it?
No, there's only one position to come, isn't there? And that's first.
First, absolutely, absolutely. Now, I'm really interested in fishmongers. We don't have enough fishmongers on the high street and they've sort of disappeared because of the supermarkets. How are you managing to make a living? So you've got your own boats and then how are you managing to sort of sell? Are you selling into restaurants? Are you selling into retail?
Well, we we sort of focus as much as our local fish as we can, which we catch on our own boats. We try and get rid of it locally to the public. And then we also have quite a lot of local trade with pubs doing their orders for the restaurant side of things, and what surplus we have, we send to London and across.
So you're mostly selling into sort of restaurants or whatever, but anybody basically who loves great fish can buy your stuff.
Yeah, we sell as soon as we land, on an evening. If there's public on the causeway where we land, then we sell directly to them. Otherwise, we've got our shop that's open on Saturday to the local public. And then we also sell to, restaurants, pubs that are local. And whatever we have surplus goes away to the London market or away to Burloin, across to France, Folkestone, and so on. We don't have a struggle getting rid of fish.
You don't, and people actually really love fish, and it's so easy to cook. And I think the problem with people at home is they don't realise that actually fish is easier to cook than meat, in my opinion. They're just a little bit frightened of it.
Yeah, it's become something that I don't think in the modern way is cooked as often as it would be, compared to the meats and everything that's available in the supermarkets. But I think if it was more widely available and if people was more aware of how to cook it, then obviously the demand would be higher. And there's a lot of low-value fish that is accessible to the public, and you can make a perfect meal for the family for a lot less than, what the supermarkets are charging for a meat or even a local fish. If you go to your local supermarkets, you're going to get a better deal.
I mean, my favourites, a mackerel is amazing. And of course, it's as cheap as anything, isn't it, mackerel? And somebody like you would fillet that, wouldn't you? And all you have to do is fry it, maybe put it in a bit of flour or whatever, and it tastes amazing.
Yeah, I mean, if we, if we do angling parties, which we do sometimes with mackerel, a lot of people like to, as soon as they catch the mackerel, literally gut it and put it straight on the pan and literally, a minute or two on each side and that's it, perfect. And maybe a little bit of salt and pepper on the top and that's it, perfect for eating it, a perfectly edible fish with minimal effort put into cooking it.
And actually, great sandwich, actually, more than anything.
Yeah, lovely. You know, yeah, no.
And I believe that your firm, it's a family firm, you were going for 50 years. You've got oyster beds as well. How does that work? I go to Whitstable sometimes, and I know you've got boats out on the swale. How do you say, I'll have some oyster beds? How does that work? How do you make that happen?
Well, we introduced the Pacific oyster into the swale 35 years ago. It was an alien species at the time, and it was an experiment. And it didn't take off initially, but after sort of 5 or 10 years of progression, eventually it took on, and now we've got an abundance of beds that are, you know, and we've got no shortage, and we can take them in a way that's economical, really, because they're self-producing. We've got it so as they're, you know, the stock is plentiful.
Just replenishes itself. Yeah. And so how does it work? You have sort of strings or whatever, ropes around sort of beds and the oysters sort of cling to those, or how does it work? I know I'm being really pathetic by saying that, Barry.
No, that's perfect. Our beds are perfectly natural, you know. It's literally just on the seabed. We've selected some hard ground, which is capable of, promoting the reproduction of oysters. And that's where they naturally live. We don't have to, you know, we don't do rope culture. We don't have to clean them regular. They are wild completely.
If they're wild completely, that means they taste amazing, though, doesn't it?
Yeah, we've had chefs from all over the country, and they've said, you know, a few of them have said that our oysters are better than what they've tasted anywhere else, so, which is good for us. You know.
That's why you've won this prize today, obviously, clearly. And then finally, you smoke fish as well, because I love smoked fish. What's your favourite fish to smoke?
What we do, which is something that not everyone else does, is we actually gillnet our own mullet, and we smoke them, and it's really popular with our customers, and that's one of our best sellers during the summer months.
Smoked mullet, how lovely. And what if you took that home, what would you have that with, just on its own? Or
literally just on its own with some homemade bread and plenty of butter on it.
You can't get better than that, can you? Okay, so just a final word for all those meat eaters out there. You need to start eating more fish, and no better place to go than Barry's family company.
Yeah, lovely job. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Nice to speak to you. So there you go. That's all about fish. And I love fish, as you know.
You're a big fan, yeah?
I'm a big fan. And I love the fact that somebody's got their own boats and they're also selling straight to restaurants. And that's really, really good. Mm. So, Lucy, welcome. You're the sort of founder of Podology. Have I pronounced that correctly?
Yeah,
Podology. Right. And in front of me, we're all very excited, actually. Well, David's licking his lips there.
My hand is kind of trembling, yes, kind of reaching.
Yes.
Ready to tuck into these delicious treats.
So we've got two... What have I got there?
I can read them from here. We've got a rich, indulgent banoffee pud.
Oh, what a shame. Yeah. And the other one?
And we've got simply sumptuous millionaire's pud.
Mm, they're both very nice. So one's very yellowy and one's very pinky on the packaging. And they're dairy and gluten-free. So tell us a little bit about the story behind that.
So it all started...
Can we open the packet while you're doing that?
Absolutely.
Yeah, great. Thank you.
Have one each. It all started in 2011, really. End of 2011. I had been dairy-free for about 2 years at that point. And I'd always worked in the food industry, so I'd been a product developer for two big retailers, and always loved food. Grew up in a family where we ate out a lot, we cooked a lot, and suddenly I had a very restricted diet, and it had taken sort of 2 years, and I had sort of got my diet on track, but I was restricted and I just didn't eat any dairy or any eggs at that point. And I realised that there was a gap in the market for indulgent products that just sort of happened to be dairy and gluten free and egg free too. So I started to make products initially for myself, and I started then testing them on sort of the normal people that still could eat everything, and everybody liked it, and nobody could believe that they were dairy free. And because I was a product developer, I kind of got my product development hat on and thought, you know, I think there's a gap here. And I went to Whole Foods and looked for everything, and there were a few things in the freezer. So Booja Booja, brilliant product in the freezer.
Yeah, really
loved
good
that.
Dairy-free truffles, aren't they?
Yeah, and dairy-free ice creams as well. So I basically just sort of got really excited and thought, I think I can do something here. I've grown up in a family where our family business was the centre of our lives. So quite an entrepreneurial sort of minded family. So my parents were both very Excited by the idea and also very supportive.
I mean, you've also got a degree in food and consumer management.
Yes.
So you didn't even, you know, I mean, you haven't got away from food at all, have you?
No, not at all. Mm. And I've always loved working in the food industry. So it was really exciting. And at that point, I had 3 products developed. And at that point, my family was sort of going, right, come on, let's go and sell them at farmers markets. Let's go and sell them here. Let's go. And I was like, absolutely not. We've got to get the branding right. Mm.
So all of this so far was just like on the kitchen table, making these things for yourself because you couldn't handle the...
Yeah.
The
so it's exactly what David's saying, you know, the brand packaging is I mean, David's just smiling really because he's tucking in.
Yeah, I'm enjoying it.
They're really delicious. The banoffee one particularly is exceptional.
But so you sort of said, let's take a deep breath here. Let's get the packaging right. Let's get the brand right.
Because I know, as I said before, you know, I love brands, and it's the brands that sell themselves to me. And then if I like the product, bonus, you know, afterwards, and that's what keeps you buying it. But I wanted the brand to have a personality. And the thing was, at the time, the free from world was pretty dire. You know, everything was very clinical, pharmacy sort of packaging. So
that's
I wanted
interesting,
to do,
actually. I hadn't really thought about that.
Yeah, so I wanted
it, and
to...
And actually marks you out as something being wrong with you.
Exactly.
I've got to go
and
down the free-from aisle.
It really was. And you know, people still can get gluten-free products on prescription. Mm. But it was very much sort of that pharmacy look. Everything was green and it just wasn't very nice. So I wanted to do something that was really quite different. So I got in contact with a designer that I used to work with when I was one of the retailers. He had just set up on his own as well. So we've worked together since the beginning.
That's brilliant.
Which has been brilliant. So
and the name, Podology?
So that was my dad, actually.
Good old dad. What's your dad's name?
Bill.
Podology.
Well done, Bill.
Oh.
Yeah. not Podology. He was... So in December, before I started the business, we were all like brainstorming ideas and my mum was coming up with ideas. And she's the creative one, I would say, out of the two of them. But my dad was in... It was either Harrods or Selfridges, where they've got the Wrapology section where they'll wrap your presents for you. Mm. So he texted me saying, what about Chocology? And everything he came up with was chocolate related because they were chocolate desserts. And I kept saying, we can't call it.
It's too restrictive.
Yeah. So then he said, okay, what about Pudology? And I was like, oh, I quite like that. Mm. So
it's got a nice ring to it.
I quite like it as a brand because it looks like you've, I wouldn't say it's medical exactly or whatever, but it looks like you've really, I don't know.
It shows there's been some research has gone into the product, right?
And you know, dairy and gluten free, you've really, really worked it out. That's what it feels like as a brand, doesn't it? Don't you think?
Yeah, so that's why we quite liked it. And it sounded quite fun as well.
The packaging's great fun. The packaging is really colourful and buzzy and energetic.
Yeah, that's kind of what we wanted to get across. And I think it helped because Mark, my designer, kind of knew me as well. So I think that really helps when you're working with people either in branding or doing social media that know you or understand you at least, that can help bring out the personality of the brand.
Well, we've just tasted the dairy and gluten-free banoffee pudding. Verdict, David?
Outstanding.
What a good word that is. Outstanding.
It's really, it's not too sweet. It's clear, isn't it? The banana-y flavour to it comes through really, really nicely. I mean, I don't know if
aren't you?
I'm quite excited. I've just had a bit of sugar, Sue, so I'm getting all excited here. I couldn't see any kind of like whole bits of banana in there, but maybe there's some in there.
We use a puree.
It's a puree, right, okay.
Right.
That's mine.
Well, that one's very nice. And then...
this was the other one here.
The other one here is the sort of, what is it, shortbread?
It's like a millionaire shortbread.
It's the millionaire shortbread.
Yeah.
You call it the millionaire's pud. That one's there's hardly any left, David. Hardly any left at all. Verdict on that one? Another word that's not outstanding.
The two of them, the banoffee is the one with the banana, isn't it? Give me
that.
That's,
you like that?
That's a favourite. The other one, I don't have a great chocolate sort of tolerance, which is
that's
in vast contrast to my wife, who absolutely loves it. So I had about half of that, and then I suddenly hit my chocolate threshold. otherwise, you're really enjoyable.
Really nice.
And the difficult thing with this, of course, is it has got shortbread. Now that, with all due respect, it's not too difficult to make chocolate that's gluten-free. It's hard to make chocolate that's dairy-free. It's always the shortbread and the biscuits and the bread.
Well,
and
shortbread
the cake
would typically
the,
be, you know, flour
really,
and butter, wouldn't it?
So really hard, and the texture of that's good.
Yeah.
The taste is good, but the texture is good as well.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we worked really hard in the early days at making sure we're getting the texture right and using the right ingredients and that kind of thing. And I think the quality of the ingredients that we use is the most important thing about what I do, because one of the things that we would never change really is the quality of the ingredients. The chocolate we use is a really good quality Belgian chocolate. And one of the frustrations for people is how expensive free-from foods are. And we try and be as competitive as possible.
And why should they be?
I want them to taste really good too.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of my big bugbears for the food industry as a whole, and not just in free-from, is the lack of understanding of actually what it takes to produce the food that we all eat. Because I know we all eat every day and it's all very commoditized and, you know, we just take it all for granted. But, you know, our food industry is a really important part of the UK.
But you've got the unique advantage here, at least, in that a lot of the consumers are going to be better educated than most about the food they're eating. And that might lend itself.
They have to be, exactly.
And that might actually lend itself to building a stronger relationship with them and also allowing you to target and to reach them around the world, as opposed to, I mean, you're not trying to carve out a slice of a mainstream market here and going up against the, you know, the rest of the brands on the main shelf. You've got the ability to actually drive the recurring purchasing from the people who are otherwise underserved and otherwise under.
Well, I've just had a text from my daughter who's gluten free, and she's just gone, "Oh my God, you've got Podology on there. Can you make sure that they don't eat them all, and like you can bring one back?"
I think we can send her some
because she knows. Because she knows.
she qualifies.
No, but I think. But
can I get on that too?
The point I'm trying to make is that because she's gluten free, and there's a sort of little community of it, they know the brands that they're really keen on.
That's what's really really nice,
And then they're loyal to it as well.
Absolutely.
So how are you selling them out? Is it all online? Are you doing recurring, like, subscription deliveries, for example?
No, so we've never really done that, because one of the challenges to that is because they're chilled products.
Right.
The distribution to get them is
much
ridiculously expensive. Yeah. And people don't want to pay the delivery charges for chilled
products.
Not
unless they're going to order 2 ton.
Exactly.
And then it's worth it.
Exactly.
But they're not going to do that, are
they? So we've never done that. I've always worked in the chilled environment, which is why I developed chilled products, because I love chilled, you know, food, basically.
But it does but give that, you a whole number of logistical and
really
production
does.
Nightmares.
I mean, it's one of those things that seemed like a really good idea at the time.
Yes, yeah, so you want to be an ambience.
But,
that's
you know,
where you want to be.
I just keep telling everyone, if it was easy, everybody would be doing it. Mm. That's what I tell myself every morning.
Yeah. So you don't sell them direct at the moment, but they're in Holland & Barrett and Ocado and Waitrose?
Yes.
And there's and Fresh as well, isn't it? Which is some kind of good food market.
Yeah, that's in Ireland. Yeah,
in Ireland. Yeah, that's the one.
And we're launching into 200 Sainsbury's stores as well next month, and we're also going to be launching into Dubai in April too.
Wow.
So
got to get the refrigeration thing right there.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, amazingly.
Good point.
Amazingly, they actually air freight product from the UK, so it's amazing. Yeah. It's an amazing logistical challenge, but which they do very well.
So going back to David's point earlier, when we were talking about funding yourself properly, you know, and it can be an advantage or a disadvantage. So it depends on how you, but you've got to go into it with your eyes wide open.
Definitely.
And obviously, for you, you know, your first job was as a food product developer in Sainsbury's, and then the same in Marks and Spencer's. So you know, you've got a good idea of the industry.
Yeah.
What's your view on sort of funding and you know, and if giving advice to people if they were going to set up?
I think what you said is absolutely true, going in with your eyes wide open. Mm. Now, how many people actually do that, I don't know. Because obviously, with 5 years' experience of doing what I've done and now looking back, I look at myself then and just sort of want to put my head in my hands and cry for her, because she was so naive. But I think everybody would probably say that about some element of their business looking back.
Well, otherwise you wouldn't do it, because you'd have to be insane to start a business.
Yeah.
Honestly,
exactly.
You really do. You have to be insane to start a business.
I think at the time I had a real lack of fear. I'm quite I don't mind taking risks. I find it quite exciting. And I think, again, you probably have to have that sort of personality to do what I've done and set a business on your own.
But it's about judicious risk taking.
It is.
Me. It's about taking risks that you've measured, you've thought about, not just jumping over a cliff.
Absolutely. And I knew that the market was growing, and that's what got me excited, and that's what made me want to take the risk.
But it really is, isn't it? And yeah. it's an interesting one. As we've looked at things over the years, we definitely see an increase in the number of products coming to market in the free from category. But I wonder is it because so many more people are realizing they have an issue, so many more people are thinking they have an issue, or is it something else, like people choose it from a health perspective, like they believe or feel or whatever that these free from products are better for them?
I think it's all of the above, basically. And that's why the market is growing so rapidly, because it appeals to lots of different types of people and lots of different life stages too. So the big one that we're always talking about is the vegan lifestyle. That's a huge growth area because it's so trendy, basically. Lots of people are doing it. There's a lot of talk about it in the media. There's lots of health and fitness people on Instagram.
But bacon sandwiches, though.
Yeah, but that's just the thing. It's not
you
being...
You could be vegan Monday to Friday.
But I think that's what a lot of people are doing.
Yeah,
they're choosing healthier options. And even though our desserts, you know, they're quite calorific, and they're, you know, they're the same as an alternative dairy-filled chocolate dessert, really. But people feel that they're healthier because they don't contain the dairy. And certainly for people like me that wear dairy, if you eat too much, it has a negative impact on you. They'd rather have something that's indulgent, that doesn't make you feel...
But indulgent but good. So
exactly.
I was gluten and dairy-free for approximately a year or two. I don't know what it was. There was some kind of, you know, I experienced issues when I ate certain types of food, and I cut them out, and fortunately now I can eat everything, which is great. Otherwise I'd be sitting in the corner here going for many of the shows that we do.
Yeah.
But the quality of so much of it is just really, really average. And average is maybe being a bit optimistic.
But it is getting better.
It is getting better, which is fantastic.
Mm. We've had a few people on here with technology looking at how they interact with their you know, consumers and customers, and trying to measure it through Wi-Fi and all sorts of other things. So I've seen quite a lot of development there, particularly in restaurants. I've been talking at some innovation conferences recently, and one of the things I've been describing is what I call the I am personalisation, which is it's about me. It's about me personalisation. And I think people are now coming to restaurants or buying products and they're going, this is me, this is my makeup. I've done a DNA test. I've got my microbiomes analysed. I've got my blood sugar stuff. You know, bread doesn't really suit me very well. This doesn't happen. That. And I think people are learning much more about their bodies and not saying this. I mean, if you think about it, it's completely ridiculous that you say a diet will suit the whole of a population. Mm. You know, everybody should be high protein, low. I mean, that's just
it's just not possible.
Thing.
No, because everybody's different.
It's about your body and what your body reacts to, and I think that's the next big thing.
Yeah.
And as a restaurateur or as a food producer, you've got to start looking at that personalization, because people are expecting not to come in and somebody says, "Oh, I'm sorry, I haven't got anything gluten free." I mean, that's just...
It's crazy.
It's ridiculous. Or we haven't got a vegan menu, or we haven't got that. You've got to embrace that now, because people are learning about themselves and then expecting somebody to be able to accommodate their preferences.
And not just their own preferences, but if you're there with, you know, four people. I know I can go out with some of my, you know, group of my friends and my family, and we've all got different requirements that, you know, 5 years ago would have been a real pain for wherever we were.
Well, I used to say, oh, for goodness sake, grow up, just eat it, don't worry, very ridiculous. Whereas now people are going, that's okay. Actually, why shouldn't you?
Yeah.
You know, you're spending your money.
And the places that are doing that are the ones that people are talking
succeeding.
About, and they get so much, you know, people tweet about it and tell their friends, this is where I want to go. And that's why, you know, the good places are sort of picking up on it, because it is really important.
Anything you're seeing in your sort of world of financing and funding? Any trends you're seeing? Apart from that, I'll just put you on the spot there, David.
I did a bit there, sorry. just thinking through that sort of theme of...
I am.
the ever-improving customization and the amount of data that is available on the individual, and the sort of the layer of products that can be built on top of that is really interesting. And I think one of the first, most obvious things you'll see in the food tech space is the big guys like HelloFresh and Gusto, who come through and say, you know, here's your weekly food box. Then Gusto says you can customize your weekly food box, and you can have you know, one of 20 different items, one or two of which are which are gluten free. And over time, the data that they gather on me by tracking my eating habits will actually build into a profile of what I like to
what
eat,
like.
And just like Amazon does with books and everything else that they're now selling, they'll say, you know, based on your purchasing history, which may be, you know, if I am gluten free, then it will be exclusively there. This is an item that we think that you'd enjoy having in this box.
Because they're learning more and more about you.
Exactly. And so the value is really in the data profile that the individual can build up. And that might be at the individual company level, or it might be aggregated across. You know, Facebook has a lot of your social data, LinkedIn has a lot of your professional data, and how does that blend into it as well? Because if you're a busy professional who usually eats at the office, that's relevant to, you know, your eating choices.
Mm. I mean, they laugh at me in the office a lot because when I put my expenses in, you know, I just give a whole bucket full of receipts to poor old Emma in the office, and she has to go through them and look. And she has an intimate knowledge of what I have for lunch when I go around London or go and visit clients. And it's like she can say, "Yeah, I do noodles again," but you're not supposed to look at what's on the receipt. You're just supposed to put it into my expenses. But just put the numbers in. Yeah.
So it's a food recommendation algorithm for you.
It's
right?
The same thing. I mean, she absolutely has a massive profile of what my preferences are, and that's what these guys are doing, aren't they?
As you say, adding the sort of the biometric data level on that, and then the genomic data level on that is just another step, and it's coming. You know, who is actually going to own the user interface for it is still unknown. I mean, Amazon is probably going to be one big player there.
They might even make a profit one day if they're lucky.
You know, even if they don't, they'll probably still continue to grow and everything else. But
own the world, but with no profit.
Yeah,
I don't understand that at all. But I'm just a business person, so I don't really get it.
You don't understand profit.
No, well, no, that's the only thing I do understand, because I know if I don't make a profit in my business, I can't pay people. So it's very simple. So I don't understand how Amazon works. Don't know how
but,
that works.
But I mean, all of that aside, that is one reason that I certainly, in your shoes, wouldn't give up on the online delivery model. I mean, it's hard, but it can be solved. But like I built a business which was delivering fresh meat and veggie products and milk and bread and things to people around New Zealand at one point. And
that's a big place to deliver, up a few mountains, cross lakes. I mean, not easy, is it?
Yeah, so we...
They're very spread out.
Yeah. They're a bit spread out,
We had the unique advantage of focusing on very densely populated... Like we actually launched the product for...
Is that anywhere densely populated in New Zealand?
We launched the product in the student markets originally, it was delivering just the basic meat products to the student market. And, of course, they all lived in the same 2 square kilometres. And we brought a truck, and the truck could do 240 deliveries at peak in the space of about 4 hours, just by driving up each street and having 2 or 3 runners that would run into the house. Refrigerated truck to front door takes 10 seconds.
There's your model, Lucy.
So if you
want to be a runner?
Yeah, if you can get the density here. But as it evolved, I mean, we did start doing courier deliveries and non-refrigerated transit. And one of the key innovations for us was actually getting in touch with a UK-based company called Woolcool, I believe they're called.
Yeah.
You've probably seen them. And I know the packaging, it's like a sort of an off-cut wool from the wool industry. And, you know, they can package with a sort of a couple of ice cubes in there and keep it cool.
Similar thing
hours,
with the Gusto and HelloFresh, so, you know, pack in their meat and cheese and dairy.
And I'd be willing to bet there'd be people out there who would subscribe to a monthly delivery of these, just like I get a monthly delivery of coffee from
Would, because none left, David. You said you didn't. You said you've reached your chocolate threshold and then you've eaten the rest of it. Don't believe him for 1 minute.
There's a threshold, and then there's food I can see that I eat. So that's another.
I have the same problem.
But you're absolutely right, and it's something that we keep coming back to.
Yep.
Because one of our big issues has always been people saying, "I can't find you anywhere. Where can I get you?" And even we're available online with Ocado, but obviously there's a minimum send. And if you're not doing your full shop there, you're not going to want to buy, you know, £40 worth of desserts. So it's something that we always come back to, and we've looked at so many times.
But from your long-term value perspective, if you rely on Ocado, then Ocado owns your customer relationship. I mean, the customer has to go to Ocado, whereas the value in this business, and just wearing the investor hat for a second, would be, is it, you know, you are owning the process that drives the repeat purchase.
Mm. Mm. And you own all the data as well.
Yeah.
And looking at, like,
great.
I said, data you know, a pound of recurring revenue is worth about 5 times a pound of transactional revenue, because you know that you can forecast the value of that customer over time. you know what and you can afford to
you don't have to spend mm. it servicing it. You don't have to spend marketing money because you've cracked that.
Mm. Yeah.
And I think if you're an entrepreneur and you're interested in the food business and you're looking for a niche, go into the packaging side, because that for me is where we're all struggling at the moment. And there's, you know, so there's people like Lucy's. There needs to be a technical solving of a problem, to make that happen. And also, there's so many deliveries happening now in terms of people not wanting to cook at home but expecting that delivery to be made. And we're seeing quite a lot of people who are sort of innovating on that packaging side. So anybody who's thinking about going to food business, my advice would be, great, yeah, please be a food producer if you want, but there are loads of you. What we're really missing is innovation in materials and food packaging and getting your product in prime condition to where it needs to be in the UK.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that we're always talking about is distribution, because the distribution of chilled products is the key challenge.
Really tough.
And even if you're using things like the wall packs, there's a lot of solutions like that work really, really well. But it's still the cost of the actual delivery, which people just don't want to pay when the items that they're buying.
Especially when it's a small ticket price item.
Exactly. You know, that's the big challenge.
You can absorb it if it's a bigger thing.
If it's a settee, that's different, isn't it? You don't mind spending £10 delivery, but not when it's a 50p pudding.
Yeah.
Not that yours are 50p.
Yeah, don't get people's hopes up.
No, I won't.
I would buy 40 if they were 50p.
And we're running out of time. So Lucy, if anybody's interested in Podology, they need to go on to dairyandglutenfreedesserts.co.uk.
Just go on to podology.co.uk and you'll find us.
And we've eaten, well, David in particular has eaten the Millionaire's Pud, but also the Banoffee Pud. But you've got chocolate pud, mango and passion fruit, coconut yogurt, Podology yogurt, and chocolate orange pud. So there's quite a nice little range there. So if you're gluten free, dairy intolerant, any of those things, go on there. But actually, if you're none of those things, just crack on with that. That's really good.
Delicious.
Yeah, absolutely delicious. And obviously, David, for Tech City Ventures, anybody interested in learning more about that, presume they can go onto your website as well.
They can. Techcity.ventures is a quite easy one to find now.
Techcity.ventures. Yep. Don't even have to be particularly good at spelling for that either. That's
nice,
just exactly as it sounds. And you're still offering these private tours for Tech City on there?
Yeah, we are. And there's a lot of other exciting stuff happening around that as well. I mean, we've just built out a partnership with Tech City UK to run some of these groups. And we've got a few other programs focused more on helping on the startup side and having companies that come through, particularly where they're selling a product into large enterprise or big government, helping them get connected and sort of develop their products.
So if you're a corporate or public or educational institution and you really want to try and understand what's going on, then Tech City Ventures is definitely for you. It really is a good connector.
It's the one.
You're like a dating agency, aren't you, really?
Sure. Dating agency for businesses.
Matchmaker, that's brilliant. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for both being on the programme. And don't forget to enter the Food Talk Awards.
Absolutely.
foodtalkawards.com. Or you can go onto the radio website, which is foodtalk.co.uk. And if any of you want to send any abuse to Guy, our Twitter handle is @foodtalkshow.
Nice questions or comments or anything like that.
Yeah.
Lovely.
So, thank you very much. Thanks for joining us both.
Thank you. Thanks for listening.
And we'll see you next week. Bye.